Welcome to Moving the Needle, casual conversations about ways big and small to impact student learning. Brought to you by the Faculty Center for Teaching and Learning at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. I'm Scott Riley, too. Let's move the needle. Welcome back to Moving the Needle, everyone. As education evolves, educators must design new methods to ensure students are not only absorbing information, but also developing the skills they need to thrive after graduation. The shift to online and hybrid education, accelerated by the pandemic and sustained by changing student needs, has brought both opportunities and growing pains. Flexibility, access, and self-paced learning are some of the clear benefits. But alongside those gains, new questions have emerged. How do we build a sense of community when students are rarely, if ever, in the same room? What does meaningful instructor presence look like in a virtual classroom? And how can we design learning experiences that are just as rigorous and engaging outside the traditional lecture hall? Today, I'm joined by returning guest Dr. Eric Belt. Together, we'll explore what community means in online education, how instructor presence shapes learning, and how we can apply a thoughtful framework of inquiry to tackle these complex questions. Dr. Belt, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to talking about it today.
Yeah, so am I. And the question I want to open with is focused on the differences between communities. And so I want you to, if you don't mind, how would you define community in an educational setting? And is there anything distinct about an academic learning community?
Sure. So when I think of community writ large, I tend to think of what makes a community, what's involved in that. You have shared purpose, relationships, maybe participation, a feeling of trust and safety. So when we think of communities in an academic setting or an academic learning community, classroom community, it sort of takes those ideas and puts them into an academic setting. So we have a specific context at a university. Our purpose is learning or teaching and learning. The relationships that we're looking at are teachers and students and students and students. And then, with community, there can be structure, design, and then almost unique in some ways, because you can think of academic learning communities at a university for a range of topics, right? Faculty sometimes have communities that they engage with professional development and learning, but in the classroom, the time frame is prescribed, it's defined. We have a start and an end to it. So when we think of classroom community in this way, there's lots of different types of classrooms. So we have in-person, probably we're almost familiar with the traditional in-person instruction, and then there's online, and online has its own unique history and roots in correspondence and distance education. And some of the other things nowadays are hybrid or high flex. There's all these different kinds of classrooms that you can find yourself in. So depending on the classroom, that will affect the community dynamics. And especially online, when there's this sort of intermediary or this technological intermediary with computer-mediated communication. So classroom community online can look and feel a little different, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not there. So I wanted to ask you, when you think back to a class that you taught, or they felt like it really clicked, where the students were engaged or connected, what do you think helped create that sense of community?
Oh man, that's a great question. I really want to highlight two things that you brought up earlier, relationships and purpose in community. And for me, I found the most success when there are these kind of informal social interactions before and after class. I always feel like there's a barrier, especially at the beginning of class when students don't really know who I am as an individual, that I try to break down by finding common ground. We talk about, favorite movies, great books we've read, favorite flavors of ice cream, very low risk things. And I don't just do it at the first class. I continue to do it to build up this relationship, this level of trust between the students that they can talk to me about, hopefully about the course content, but about other things in their lives as well. And then the other thing that I found is really useful for success in a classroom is student ownership. So the idea of, at least for me, kind of an adjacent purpose to learning is how much they are invested in the content, how much they are willing to take ownership of their own learning. And that kind of goes hand in hand, in my opinion, with the building of relationships and building of trust.
Yeah. So that sense of shared space and rapport that you're describing with community and forming a sense of community is one of the things that we try to do in the online environment. And we have to be intentional about it with our presence, our tone, how we design our courses. And it can certainly feel a little different when we're not physically together. So leading up to and around the turn of the 21st century, there's a lot of researchers that started exploring this idea of community in online learning environments. They started asking, how does community form, or does it form? And there were a lot of criticisms and critiques about online education at that time. Is it as effective, or is it as good? And there were a lot of media comparison studies at that time, and they all kind of led toward no significant differences, meaning that it can be just as effective to teach online as it is in person. So one of the most cited or seminal frameworks around that time was the Community of Inquiry Framework by Garrison and colleagues. I think it was published in the year 2000. And what they did to kind of have an academic conversation with some of the critics was to, all right, we have this research question about community, does it form? Let's see if we can study it. So they looked at discussion forums, asynchronous text-based discussion forums and online courses, and they coded them qualitatively. And they were able to sort of inductively and deductively come up with sort of this theory or this framework of community of inquiry, where things that people say in those discussions are representative of these presences that I'm going to talk about in a sec. But that, you know, teaching presence, social presence, and cognitive presence. So those are the three big presences in the community of inquiry framework. So cognitive presence is really about how students make meaning. You know, it's not really just about memorizing facts, but it's about giving them opportunities to reflect and connect ideas and problem solve and apply. It's the thinking part of the framework, and it's what we hope students are really doing with the material, you know, processing it, stretching it, challenging it. Social presence, a lot of people love social presence, get really enamored by this concept, but it started before this framework. There was a group of researchers, I think they were in London in the 70s, that were studying whether or not the salience or the personality or the sense of a person could come through in computer or mediated communication. They were looking at telephones, actually, to see if I can get a sense of this person just by talking to them on the phone. So that's kind of where social presence came about. And then it entered into this framework. And, you know, is how much of a presence personality came through in this communication. It's basically, in the context of this framework, just about helping students feel like they're real people in a real community. There's a human element, you know, even if they're behind their computer screen. So, and the last presence is teaching presence. That's where, you know, as we, as the instructors of our online courses, are trying to shape the learning experience. And it's not just about content delivery, but it's also about the design of the course, how we're guiding students through the material, the discussions that we're facilitating with them, how we're responding to their work and their assignments or their needs sort of along the way. And it's how students know someone is there, guiding them and supporting them and making the course feel like a more purposeful experience rather than just a list of tasks.
So this is a really cool idea. The question of, does community emerge or exist in online teaching? Building the community of inquiry framework is just really interesting to me. And you've discussed like the three primary elements of it, the cognitive presence, the social presence, and the teaching presence. And so I guess my next question is, with all of these presences, right, with all these components of the framework, does it actually help instructors or institutions design better learning environments?
I think so. You know, when we get into frameworks or models or conceptual ways of thinking about things, it gives us stuff to think about that we might not have otherwise been thinking about in just the normal course of our lives. So I think that the community of inquiry framework, it provides a language for analyzing and in some ways improving student engagement. So, you know, with all of these, you can make the case, you know, how this framework came to be in an online space, but you could apply this to in-person instruction, hybrid instruction, and all the different kinds of classrooms and classroom communities that are out there. And people have, researchers have, been trying to explore this. I think it's why it's a really solid framework. It kind of just explains what's happening very well. And so I wanted to ask you, you've designed lessons, didactic sessions, case-based sessions, whatever you want to call them. So let me ask you, when you reflect on those experiences, which part of your teaching feels most essential to helping students move from simply hearing information to really working with it?
Man, do we have another like 2 hours to talk about this? If I have to pick like quickly, like my reaction to that question is discussion, I feel like is key, especially when you're talking about the cognitive presence aspect of things. When I'm designing, you know, case studies for the classes, I really want to focus on getting the students to talk amongst themselves. And my presence is more of like a facilitation presence to kind of make sure things are going on the right track. And then the other thing that I think may fall under the teaching presence category, and you can let me know, is creating a space that encourages questions. I really think that when you're talking about getting students to do more than memorize material, having them think, not just think critically about it, but ask questions to each other and of me, the facilitator, is really what's going to get them to learn on a deeper level.
Yeah, that's great. And that's absolutely a part of teaching presence and cognitive presence. You know, it's kind of hard to depict on an audio podcast, but the visual of the framework can be helpful in some ways because it's three concentric circles where certain aspects of the presences overlap to create this image of an educational experience. And then they've sort of called out certain parts of things where social presence and teaching presence overlap. I think they call it setting the climate. Or, you know, so they've kind of labeled aspects and exactly what you're describing there. So, you know, it's right at the heart of the community of inquiry, everything that you're talking about there, and how students build and confirm meaning through that sustained reflection and dialogue. That's cognitive presence. And importantly, you know, the teacher needs to be there to sort of help steer the conversation in the right way.
Okay, good. I was having a really hard time separating them, and now I know that the model's image is that there's overlap. That makes me feel really good as a teacher then. But I now want to focus a little bit on social and cognitive presence a little bit and ask, what's the biggest challenge in fostering these things like cognitive presence in an online or asynchronous environment? Because you aren't physically there, right?
That's all of our challenges, right? Sometimes it feels like pulling teeth, or we ask ourselves, why aren't students engaging with this? Or we really want them to discuss things, and it can feel distant, it can feel cold and isolating. So there are things that we do from a design standpoint to try to help with those. You know, if you make things a little bit more accessible, predictable, those kinds of things can help. Having a sort of similar structure in a module from one module to the next. And because once you know as a student where things are, then you can start to engage in other ways. So familiarity and kind of knowing how to operate the learning environment is one thing. And then to your point about, you know, the challenge where this comes out in cognitive and social presence, one way to think about it could be that social presence creates the conditions under which cognitive presence can flourish. So when a student feels connected and supported in their learning, then they are more likely to ask questions, to engage in the intellectual, or take intellectual risks, to engage in the dialogue, to, you know, be more comfortable not knowing or being wrong. So it sort of creates, you know, when you feel like you're in a social community and you're supported by a teacher, there's a psychological safety that supports this deeper cognitive processing. So, you know, if they don't feel safe, you know, there's a lot of reasons why students don't engage, but this is an example of how one way in which it can kind of come about. And if they don't feel like they're part of a community, they might show up to the course online, but they won't necessarily show up to the conversation. So that's where we see the cognitive presence stall out. So there's research that has shown that cognitive presence increases when social presence is well established, particularly online. And because of that, you know, students tend to reach deeper phases of inquiry. And which includes integration and resolution. So those are sort of terms from the literature, but how, if you're analyzing a discussion forum, how deep is the conversation getting, right? Is it surface level? This is why I'm studying in the program, happy to be here, right? Or are we taking a deep dive, having a really big, intellectual conversation about material? And the deeper you go and the more safe people feel and communicated about those things, then, you know, all of that psychological safety just supports the social dynamics, risk-taking, it creates a mutual respect. All those things sort of fuel the fire that helps the community.
Yeah, this concept of psychological safety driving deeper cognitive presence really resonates with me as a teacher, because I, at least in my experience, I found that a lot of times if I go into the classroom and, you know, nobody's willing to engage or discuss, I have to kind of ensure to them that this is a place that it's okay to make mistakes and to ask questions that might not be the best questions. One of my favorite opening lines is I always go, okay, if nobody's going to ask a question, I'll ask a question. What's 2 + 2? 5. And then everybody gives me this weird look. And I'm like, look, even the professor can be wrong here, you know, but we're not going to get anywhere if you guys don't, you know, engage with the content. So feel free to ask me anything and we'll work through it together. And I find that kind of, I guess I want to use the lightheartedness disarms a lot of students or reassures a lot of students that it's a safe space to make mistakes, to ask questions. Because if the professor can say something silly like that, then it's okay to ask questions that they're not confident in.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good example. It touches on all of the presences in some ways. You know, there's a social element to that. It gets people thinking, you know, especially when they're caught off guard. And then there's a teaching presence that, you know, you're saying, we can talk. It's okay, you know, because there is that, I'd say the power dynamic between teacher and students is, you know, it asymmetrically tilts in favor of the teacher. There's a natural, it's natural for students to feel a little hesitancy when interacting with teachers or for, you know, myriad reasons. So when you're teaching and you're working through something tough, like a pharmacological mechanism, how would you support students in moving from just recalling that content to actually applying it?
So I'm a really big fan of active learning techniques, and this works really well with case studies because I kind of flip the script on the students and ask them to look at this scenario with all the information that they have and come up with the answers to several questions that I have at the bottom of the case study. And while this is going on, I find that my greatest success comes from when I like just kind of pop into different study groups and ask them, you know, I look at one of their answers. It can be completely right or it can be completely wrong. It doesn't matter. And I can ask them like, hey, can you explain your thinking here? And that does a lot to drive the students to really question, you know, is this answer correct? Why is this answer correct or incorrect? And so I find that that is one of the best ways that I can support students, because it also helps other students jump in when they're like, oh, I didn't think about it that way. I was thinking about it this way. And their combined perspective provides a much richer and deeper answer than the individual perspectives.
Yeah. And that really gets at these presences again, you know, with cognitive presence, teaching presence, and social presence. And, you know, what you described in terms of what I'm assuming is in-person, you know, going group to group and kind of checking in, right? That kind of interaction is what we would say, you know, on the surface, harder to achieve in the online environment because it's a little jarring to be trying to do that with technology or feeling like other people aren't there. So we just have to be intentional about how we design those interactions and those group things. I was just reflecting on what you're sharing there and trying to apply it to the online space where that can kind of happen, but it just has to be intentionally thought out and planned. Something I found over the years is that students, you know, before they even get into that group work or taking those deeper dives in the discussions or you know, doing the heavier lifts, is that they need to feel connected. You know, they need to feel like they're a part of the group or part of the community. So that's where the social presence piece, I think, is really important to just helping students feel like they're seen and that they belong in the space and that there's an opportunity for them to engage, especially online.
What are some things that you've done to intentionally encourage social presence or nurture social presence in an online classroom?
Anything that we can kind of do to diminish that perceived psychological distance between the teacher and the student, I think helps with social presence. So, you know, things that I would do would be, you know, welcome videos. I might have a welcome video that it could be two different things. It could be me explaining this course and what it's all about, or it could be me just saying, this is who I am as a person, or, you know, whatever I want to share. So videos can help in that. If, you know, if we're sticking to the strictly asynchronous where you have to kind of be cautious and wary about interspersing live meetings. If you can do Zoom sessions, do those. You know, and I've seen people try to do virtual office hours or check-ins or offer, you know, flexibility in their calendars to meet with students in that way. I also see it in the feedback that we provide to students. That's one of the most direct ways in which the student sees us, is the comments that we provide to their essays or their grades and the feedback that we give them. In the discussion forums, that's another way that they'll see that you can be present and show your presence online. So when looking back at the courses that you've taught, I'm wondering, what do you think the students are most likely to remember? What you taught, how you taught it, or how you made them feel?
That's an excellent question. And going back to the concept of feedback, it's one of my personal, I know it can be a nightmare for some faculty, but it's one of my personal favorite times to really take in what the students felt, what their perspective was. Because I, you know, all semester, I think I'm doing a great job. And so it's really good to get that feedback from students to either, you know, reinforce what I thought or help me get grounded a little bit. And two pieces of feedback that I constantly make a note of every year when I see them, and they come up frequently, is that the feedback that I give students, generally speaking, written feedback that I give students, is impactful and meaningful. It's not like just, hey, you got this wrong. If I ask students to explain their thinking, I often try to explain my thinking to the fullest extent about why I took points off for something and where the gap was, so that they get a complete understanding of what went wrong or what could be improved in a specific area. And I've gotten a lot of positive feedback that Dr. Riley's feedback is meaningful and useful. You know, the other thing that comes up a lot, and this is, I should like frame this quote because it's come up like three times in different classes, is that Dr. Riley asks us more questions than we ask him. And I really appreciate that about him, is that he doesn't just feed us the information, but he asks us questions that we didn't even think to ask. And that really helps us to dig in. But it boils down to, he asks us more questions than we ask him. And I've always liked that feedback. Makes me feel like I'm doing a great job if they look at that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's reassuring to hear those sorts of things, you know, that it's resonating well. And I think that's a demonstration of care in what you're doing. And, you know, I think students pick up on those things, you know, and it might not feel it as rewarding, right, in the online space or in the moment. Maybe you'd have to wait till you get your course eval and they say something that's really nice and you're like, yeah, that's great. That gives me enough energy to do this again next semester. But yeah, it's that idea of care and consistency, that, you know, I think in some ways is speaks to teaching presence in the community of inquiry framework. You know, yes, we teach, but it's also how we sort of create the conditions for others to engage with the material, to think, to feel safe enough to learn. I think what you mentioned there with your feedback, I think that is also sets the condition for feeling safe enough to engage in the next assignment or the next exit. They might take more risks knowing that this is the kind of feedback that I'm going to get or I'm going to get. It's a safe place for me to take risks. So all good things there.
Absolutely. And so we're on the topic of teaching presence, and we've kind of focused on what we do as teachers, right? I'm interested, or I guess I'm curious, since you're more familiar with this framework than I am, can students or peers ever contribute to teaching presence specifically in online courses?
Absolutely. And it's an interesting sort of aspect or maybe an Easter egg about the framework is that the researchers there intentionally labeled the construct teaching presence, you know, the gerund form, the ing, teaching, as to not suggest that it's teacher presence, like that it's the teacher, that an individual, you know, as to not suggest individuality in how that presence is embodied in this framework. So there's some researchers or scholars that have kind of explored this, and they might call it instructor social presence or different things along the way. But the idea, I think what you're asking there is, can students contribute to teaching presence? And yes, right? Because in a community of learners, everyone's coming in with their experience, their expertise, their lived experience, their background, their working environments, what they lived through. So that adds to the conversation, adds depth and nuance. And, you know, if that person, that student, is contributing in a way that extends the conversation or goes deeper down a rabbit hole or something, then that is, in essence, teaching presence, because others are benefiting from that as well. So it's, I think naturally when we think of the community of inquiry framework and we get to teaching presence, when I first read that, I was like, okay, that's everything I need to do, right? That's me. But in actuality, because it's a framework and just a model, it can come out in different ways. Students can be a part of it. And I guess that's leading me to a question, which is, do you think this idea of teaching as intentional design or intentionally doing these things in online learning environments was lost a little bit during the pandemic or emergency remote teaching?
I was wondering, I knew we can't talk about online teaching without talking about the pandemic, right? And I think this is a great question, because whenever I think of online teaching, I think of it in two different time zones or time categories, you know, not the pandemic and the pandemic, because very much, at least for me, the pandemic was just, it can be described with one word, and that's rushed, right? You went from, hey, online teaching's great, do one or two courses that, you know, aren't necessarily part of the core curriculum. And then we can have this great, you know, online presence as well as an in-person presence. But then immediately it had to be everything's online. And I know that it was really difficult to replicate the feel of a well-planned course, because I essentially had to make new courses, because as a STEM teacher, a lot of what we do is in the lab. It's experiential. So there's a lot of presence involved in those experiments that is, I still don't know if I got it right with respect to trying to do it during the pandemic. And so, you know, from your perspective, how do we draw that line? Because this was very much emergency remote teaching, right? And what you and I are talking about feels more like well-designed online learning or intentionally designed online learning. So how do we draw that line between the two?
I remember maybe it was 2020, you know, early 2020 or what, March, right? So my initial feeling was, oh no, like millions of people are going to have a horrible experience with online teaching, because, you know, a lot of people are less aware, less familiar that, you know, online teaching, we've been researching and studying it for 30, 40, 50 years now. Like where there's a field of scholars that are dedicated to this kind and format of education. And we learned a lot of things over the years. So I think that emergency remote teaching, it's just a reaction, right? It was necessary, but a reactive solution to a problem. You know, online courses, like what we're talking about, when they're intentionally planned, there's a difference to it. The student experience is very intentionally thought out before the course begins. Now, I'm kind of making some broad sweeping overgeneralizations about how some people might approach online learning even pre-pandemic. But in theory, pre-pandemic, online courses, and now, you intentionally design the experience. And that takes work and prep and to think about, okay, all of the assignments and activities I'm going to do. It's less, you know, online, teaching online, there's less opportunity for riff, I want to say, or improv, in that, you know, when I was teaching in person, I might slap together my lesson for the day, morning of, and I'm teaching it at night, and I'm rolling, and I'm keeping everybody along. But when it gets to online, there's a change, and it needs to, you know, everyone needs to sort of recognize that. And I think people, you know, everyone got a crash course in it when the pandemic hit, you know, of what that means. Oh, I can't just do what I'm doing in person online and have the same effect. There's an alignment piece to it that we think about a lot. My learning objective, my activity, my assessment of it, it's all sort of tied together into a nice package. And all of that, in theory, is created well before the student even logs into the course. And that's the difference, I'd say. An interesting thing that's happening now with online education is formerly, let's say early 2000s, it was a no-no to like add a synchronous session into a fully asynchronous online course. And there's a lot of people get into the nuances of this aspect of it, of completely distance online education. So one of the maybe silver linings of this is the bichronous online learning, which is just the pairing of asynchronous, what was traditionally fully asynchronous, and now synchronous online learning, like the Zoom sessions and things like that. So I think that that bichronous online learning can sort of deepen presence and connection in the community without losing the flexibility of online learning. So if you were to redesign an element or just one element of a course that you were teaching to try to build a stronger sense of community, where do you think you would begin?
So with online courses, I hate to admit this, but I think I've fallen into that focused mindset of alignment, right? Building the course before the students even get in. And I really haven't thought about what I do when the course is going on. I think the one thing that I do right is that I have a weekly AMA or Ask Me Anything for my coding course, where essentially I show up with no agenda. Students can choose to show up or not choose to show up, and they can literally ask me anything about the course content. But that being said, I really want to focus a lot more on social presence, simply because from the grades that I've seen, from the content that students provide, they're doing the cognitive presence. Like they're invested in the coding and the data analytics, because at the end of the day, they do really good work. And I think that social presence, and I've got to figure out tangible ways of improving social presence, but I think social presence very much connects or encourages the other two anyways, the teaching presence, because you need teaching presence. You don't need it. Teaching presence helps social presence, and cognitive presence is encouraged when social presence is present. And so with that, I'd like to think about more ways to engage my students and have the students engage each other in the online courses that I'm teaching. And I don't want to give any tangible answers yet because I want to research more. Another thing that I want to change is in evaluations. I'm thinking about adding cognitive presence, teaching presence, and social presence as evaluation metrics to say, how engaged, did you just show up to class or did you show up to the conversation, right? Cognitive presence, or you know, how connected did you feel with your other peers while learning this content? Did you feel like I was present even though I wasn't physically present? Did you feel like a teacher was there to help you out when you needed it? And so now I'm curious about what would happen if I added those metrics in to evaluate the course.
Oh, you just got me thinking about a couple of different things there that we should probably mention about community of inquiry framework. But so community of inquiry, you know, when you're talking about the student engagement piece and the social presence piece, I think in some ways, you know, we were talking about a very idealized learning environment, right? So it's theoretical. And in the practicality of it, you could say that it sort of takes two to tango in some ways, in that you can kind of set out all the expectations or, you know, try your darndest to get students to come in to the environment and to engage and to communicate and discuss and get involved. And sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't, right? So I think that's part of it too, in that, you know, or at least something we should mention, that the social presence, sometimes, it's, you know, people are different, right? There's a different... Early days, there was a term called the lurker, in online literature. And lurking was a phenomenon of just being a part of the course, not contributing at all, but you were there. You read everything, you saw all the discussion forums, but you just never felt that urge to communicate. So lurking is a common phenomenon in online classes. So your students, you might not be able to know that they're there and present and engaged, but they're doing things, and that's tough. From a teacher's point of view to kind of see how to handle with that. And another thing is the disinhibilitation effect of online teaching or communicating in online environments, where I'd say there's a double-edged sword. So on one side, there's this freedom of expression, right, where you can say what you want to say without the physical consequence of being in front of a person in the room. And because of that sort of effect, I might say things that I might not otherwise if I was in person. So that's part of it too. But I would say the other side of this sword, which I believe to be more important, is that in an asynchronous online course, I think a lot of research and literature will point to or tell you about how that asynchronous nature allows deeper conversations to happen. Because everyone, which can't happen in person, right? But you can pause and think and really reflect on what you're going to contribute to this discussion, to this assignment, to this activity. And it's baked into that asynchronous nature of the course. If I'm in a live session teaching students, you might have a second or two to pause and think before you communicate, but imagine having a day to sit with that really tough intellectual thing and then respond.
So I really like the note that you've provided at the end about how this allows students to really think about their answers. And that, to me, creates a large effect of psychological safety, allowing them to go deeper. And so I think that edge of the sword is much sharper than the other edge. And it's made me really want to consider how I can incorporate COIs into all of my classes.
Absolutely.
Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking about COI with me.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed our chat.
Thank you for joining us today on Moving the Needle. Visit us at umaryland.edu/FCTL to hear additional episodes, leave us feedback, or suggest future topics. We'd love to hear from you.